the second half of the summer 2023 movie season. This is Geek Confidential. Podcast. My name is Luke Kerr. Joining me today, Melody Akles. Welcome, Mel.
Hey, hey.
Mo Walker. Welcome, Mo.
I'm glad to be back and recording.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this. I really enjoyed the first half of the summer movie season podcast. And so I thought, let's wrap up it now that we're past Labor Day and talk about some of the other movies that stood out for us for the last half of the summer movie season, which is, for the purposes of this podcast, basically going to be July 4th through Labor Day weekend. Now, before we dive into that real quick, on the last episode, Melody had not had a chance to watch The Little Mermaid yet, but she has recently. So what's your quick take on Little Mermaid?
So overall, I did enjoy the movie. I love Halle. That's her name. Halle, Haley, Bailey. Yep. Forgive me. She did a really good job as Ariel. She has a beautiful voice. I loved her take on it. I thought Melissa McCarthy knocked it out of the park as Ursula. I thought her take was really genuine and a lot true to the original. The only hangups I had with the movie is that I felt it went long. Like, I think we could have cut 30 minutes out of that movie and everything would have been just fine. But I enjoyed The Little Mermaid. It was a good remake.
Was the CGI at the end as bad as I said it was?
You know, it definitely has some questionable CGI moments. It needed some help there. But then again, you know, it's supposed to be a movie for kids. So,
but for all the money they spent on the live action version, there was some janky CGI in a couple places. Costuming, either one, however you want to put it.
I thought they did a good job with the costuming, but the CGI was a little.
Okay.
I didn't care for the guy who played Eric, though.
Oh, interesting.
I could have went without
him. Why was that?
He wasn't giving to me. Like, if you think about the 1989 movie, you know, Prince Eric, that was a good looking man. That was okay, let me pay attention. I understand why you want to give up your fins and have legs for him. This guy, I don't know. I probably would have stayed in the ocean.
Note to listeners, Mel is not giving up her fins for...
Not for him. We have to pick somebody else.
Okay. Well, on that note, let's talk a little bit about some of the other movies that have happened this summer. Mo, Tom Cruise came back. The last couple of years he's dominated, whether it was Mission Impossible or a Top Gun Maverick. He's been like Mr. Summer Movie Man. What did you think of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1?
Well, I think as a Mission Impossible fan, I was really happy to finally get this next installment in the Mission Impossible franchise. And I think Tom Cruise was, you know, true to form as Ethan Hunt. There were no missteps here. I think that, unfortunately, and we'll probably get into this a little bit more later on, is this movie was overshadowed. First by the Oppenheimer effect. I think also the fact that this is a two-part film. So, Dead Reckoning Part 1 was the summer of 2023. And, you know, unless something happens, you know, we're expecting Dead Reckoning Part 2 in 2024. And I think that narratively, we got a complete installment and we got the stakes raised, in some cases, literally, for the next installment. I just think that for whatever reason, the public wasn't feeling it. And I think that, you know, and I'm just not sure if if public sentiment, I don't think public sentiment has necessarily turned against Tom Cruise. I think that maybe people wanted something fresh and new, and this wasn't fresh or new. It was just a very well-told Mission Impossible film, and that it's very timely as well, dealing with AI.
See, and that's the thing that I've really struggled with about it, because I love this film as well. I actually think that this is one of the best Mission Impossible films that has ever been released. I thought that the plot was well crafted, the characters were fun, the action was fantastic. I mean, it hit, it checked every single box, and yet it didn't do well. And I've been trying to figure, by comparison to what one would expect for this film. I mean, it did decent, but it didn't do as big of stuff. And I don't think that it's a matter of people like needing somebody fresh. I mean, we had Fast and the Furious, what, 10, 11, 12, 13 this year? I mean, people will come back for those things in the franchises. I think the problem might have been the, even though I thoroughly enjoyed it, this was not a problem for me, but I think what may have been problematic is the villain isn't actually that clear when you look at the trailers. When you think about really good movies, usually you can figure out one of two things. Like, if you're going to go with a person who's an actual villain, then you'll see who that villain is in the trailer. If you're going to go with something where, like, say, The Matrix or The Net with Sandra Bullock from back in the day, that was very, both of those are very specifically computer, like, technology, this stuff is going to destroy you. So on one hand, you can have movies like where you have a very clear human villain. On the other hand, you can have technology. I don't think that this trailer, or the trailers for this film, necessarily conveyed who the villain was, because they actually told a nuanced story about how AI was using humanity to do villainous things for the AI's survival. And that becomes a very complicated plot to try and condense down into a very short trailer. So maybe it's that, but that's the only thing that I could think of, was that possibly people didn't really understand the motivation this time.
Well, okay, I can definitely see that. I can see, I think, I will say, in terms of being menacing, Essie Morales's Gabriel was really, really struck a great chord. He came across as very psychotic. I did have a little bit of a problem, because they had introduced this backstory between Gabriel and Ethan, and I was scratching my head wondering, had we met Gabriel before? But based on what I looked up online, that, you know, that was pretty much a plot line that was just developed for this film, for Dead Reckoning. Now, I think had it, the seeds of this had been sown a little bit better, maybe, you know, using Gabriel kind of as that conduit, you know, is the representative of the Big Bad, would have probably gone a bit better had that character really been truly connected to something from one of the previous films.
That leads into another aspect. You have AI, you have Gabriel, and then you bring in the White Widow. I feel like they just had too much confusion going on about who the villains were. Because you start doing masks, which is very Mission Impossible. You start having AI, you start having this person from a flashback, and they're adding in backstory. Like, if you can actually get people into their seats, everybody who I've seen who I've talked to who's actually seen the movie has thoroughly enjoyed it. But the people who haven't seen it have been like, I'm not sure, that looks a little bit weird, you know? And I feel like it's just trying to convert them somehow to get them into the seats. And that's where the problem was. Because once you get in, I've had a number of people who are like, we're not sure what's going to happen, but you get into the film and they've enjoyed it.
Well, and then plus, let alone the two other, I would say, Henry, Czerny,
yep,
from Revenge, it's Kitteridge. I mean, you know, him being a power broker and another adversarial character. Because it's Mission Impossible, you're gonna wonder who's gonna stab whom in the back, just like you're expecting the mass. So to have that character, you know, do a heel turn and so forth later in the film felt very natural. But again, I do think that does also add to another layer of, here's another quote unquote villain, let alone Shay Wiggum's Briggs, who was just chasing Ethan throughout the film. And we only got hints about whatever the rationale for him going after Ethan. And I think, again, it has something to do with Ethan's past. Maybe like a loved one of Briggs got killed because of Hunt or something like that. I wish they'd at least wrap that up in the first film, or at least we got that character's motivation clearly spelled out, because that's one less thing we've got to cover in the next installment. Because you've already got Gabriel, you've got Kitteridge, you've got this rogue AI. That's three things right there you've got to deal with, plus whatever's going on with the rest of the IMF team.
And the White Widow will show back up too. You know,
yeah,
that's going to happen.
Yeah.
Mel, now I know you haven't seen this film, but is there any reason why, like, is there anything specifically that made it so it's like, oh, I'm not going to a Mission Impossible movie, or was it you just didn't have time?
So I admittedly have not been really big on the Mission Impossible films. I'm not a big spy film person. Like, I know everybody loves James Bond, but I just it doesn't overly interest me. Like, if it's something of, if somebody wants to go and see it and they want me to come, okay, sure, I'll come, but I'm not going to actively seek it out. I think the last Mission Impossible I saw was maybe 5. Like, they just kind of lost me along the way. There isn't anything in, like, against it. I'm just like, meh.
Well, one movie I know you saw was Blue Beetle.
Yes, I did.
And I can't wait to hear what you thought of it, because not only did you see it, but then you ran into the lead actor at the movie theater that you were watching it at.
Yeah. So we'll start with the movie first. Going in, I was really excited to see it because I didn't know much about the Blue Beetle character. I kind of know like the origins and the things that he was about, but I didn't know much about it. So I was like, I know this is going to be the newer version, Jaime Reyes and his family and how everything comes into it. And going into it, that was kind of my mind frame. And I really, really enjoyed this film. I love how they set up Jaime. You know, he graduated from college. He went to college in Gotham. I thought that was really interesting. A lot of little Easter eggs there. And he has this really loving family, but they're struggling. And it's because of the city that they live in and the villains that are around. What is the company's name? Mo,
Cord.
Help me.
Cord Industries.
Yes. So Cord Industries is the conglomerate taking over, and his family lives in an area that has been theirs for a very long time, but the corporation is intruding on them. So he's having to deal with that. And, you know, he's trying to make sure he has a job to help take care of people. And I relate to that so much. And he finally goes and he gets the interview, and then all hell breaks loose and he happens to get into some things that maybe he shouldn't have, and he didn't follow instructions, and he opens a box and the Blue Beetle suit, it bonds with him. It's an alien in this version. I thought that was really interesting, but I loved the suit. I thought the action scenes were really great. I loved the story. a lot of heart-tugging scenes too, because I did not expect the dad to pass away. Spoiler alert. That was a lot, but I would love that if DC really gave this character a chance and gave this movie a chance, because I want to see more about Abuela, more of her story. She was a G in
yes,
it. Like,
she was.
She was so great. I just thought it was a really well told, put together film. Of course, you know, it's DC, so there's a little cute questionable CGI things, but if the story is strong enough, I'm willing to forgive those more often. But I really enjoyed it. It was great. And then after, so as I'm coming out of the movie, it was a later showing in the day, and there was all these people in the lobby, and I kind of didn't pay attention because the theater I went to is huge. So there's always a lot of people, but people weren't moving. They were just standing there. And I went with my friend, and we were like, what is going on? Like, why are people just standing here? And all of a sudden, somebody was like, oh, the star of the film, Blue Beetle, Jaime Reyes, is played by Xolo Mariduena. I hope I said that
right. I'm glad you pronounced
so
that, because I would not be able to.
Butchered that, but that was my attempt. He was really great, and he was just there in the lobby taking pictures, signing autographs, anything you wanted, and was the nicest man. He really, really was. Like, and we talked about Cobra Kai a little bit, and he was excited about that, and that we were all just really supportive, and they had posters to give. It was just a really fun experience, and one I'm really happy I ended up going to the later showing, because I almost went to a showing before that and I would have missed him. So he really was just out in the lobby hanging out and was super gracious, and I was really thankful.
Mo, what did you think of Blue Beetle?
I really enjoyed it, and it, you know, Mel covered a lot of aspects of the film that I enjoyed. The family, the you know, it really is this iteration of Blue Beetle is, you know, it's the DC Latinx version of Spider-Man. And which, you know, it's a universal story that's very easy to understand. I'm surprised, Mel. You didn't see Batman Brave and the Bold, because this version of Blue Beetle would appear on that cartoon sort of frequently back in the 2000s.
No, I didn't see that one.
Okay, and then this iteration of Blue Beetle also was on Young Justice as well. And so I appreciate that how they, one, were able to integrate the various iterations of Blue Beetle into this film. You know, I didn't think that it oversaturated, overpowered the film, that it maintained, you know, the focus on the Reyes family. But the fact that, you know, Dan Garrett was mentioned, and Ted Kord obviously was a key component of the film, you know, certainly in spirit, though not physically there, but his physical representation was his daughter, Jenny, which is an interesting twist, because in the DC comics, we've gotten iterations of the Jaime Reyes character in which Ted Kord has been a quote-unquote mentor to this version of the Blue Beetle after he stopped being Blue Beetle, or, you know, was being a part-time superhero. So I really thought that in addition to the Abuela character, George Lopez's character was fantastic, in my opinion. I thought that, you know, there were some parts where it felt like his uncle was, that uncle character was going to not only jump the shark, but eat the film. And then George Lopez just pulled it back and just had so much emotion that it was so fun, because, you know, They did a great setup by making sure you knew the family, understood the family dynamic before you had Jaime meet up or gain possession of the Scarab. And I think that that was really important because it helped the audience. It helped the audience make sure that you know, behind all the superheroics and the questionable CGI, at the heart of this film is literally the story of this family who is just trying to struggle in a world in which, you know, they're going to be pushed out because they're working class people, and how this one individual within this family unit who thought he'd made it and could help his family by going to college now has to assume another role and has to assume much more of a leadership or I wouldn't say the somewhat patriarchal role within this family after the passing of his father. It was a great family story at the end of the day.
What did you guys think of Susan Sarandon as the villain?
Okay. So again, for me, I mean, that was some scenery chewing. I mean,
was it good scenery chewing or bad scenery chewing?
I thought certain scenes, it was good scenery chewing. I thought when she first met Jaime and, you know, her interactions with her niece Jenny Cord, you know, that was some good scenery chewing. Just the way she was just throwing her weight and power around. I think by the end, though, it was just too much at the end. I think that she just really just needed to dial it back. It was if like she needed to match the CGI because the CGI was just so bombastic and so ridiculous at the end, as it is in like most of these superhero films, and particularly these DC films, that it felt like she just needed to top the absurdity of the CGI fights.
Mel, what did you think of Susan Sarandon?
I think she was definitely in her "I am a villain, hear me roar, see, so, I'm bad." But I do agree that with Mo, that some of it was good scenery tuning and some of it was, "All right, Susan, girl, let's chill out." I get it, but
I really enjoyed a lot of the family elements that you guys talked about. To me, this felt very, how do I put this? So you know how the first Shazam was very heartwarming, but yet was a lot of fun and had some great action? That's what this, to me, felt like. And I think that the adult characters in his family were great. I don't know that he had a ton of chemistry with the love interest, but it wasn't bad. The action was a ton of fun. I would love to see another one of these, but who knows how that's going to all play out in light of everything that's happening at Warner Brothers. But speaking of Warner Brothers, Oppenheimer was one of the two biggest movies of the season, that and Barbie. I had no desire to see Oppenheimer. I did not get caught up in the Barbenheimer mania. I know that Mel has not seen Oppenheimer. Mo, did you go to it? Or was it also one that you just are like, "I'm going to skip it"?
No. I saw Oppenheimer. I will be honest with you. I was a bit shaky on whether or not I was going to go. But it just so happened that I have access to one of the, like a movie pass. So, you know, it was, I basically paid like the cost. It was the cost of reserving my seat. And for a 3-hour biopic that really only had one big action scene in which a bomb is detonated, I was fully riveted and engaged. And I think that it was certainly due to the performances. Cillian Murphy just knocked it out of the park as Oppenheimer. I think he was well matched by Emily Blunt as his, I think she was his wife, his second wife, as Kitty Oppenheimer. It was so good. Part of it is because it's not told sequentially. it's told out of order. So you're jumping back and forth between these congressional hearings with Robert Downey Jr.'s character, Lewis Strauss. And you're getting bits and pieces of information. Again, it's the type of storytelling that Christopher Nolan has perfected over the decades, certainly with Memento and other films. I think that you two should definitely watch Oppenheimer, when it hits streaming. But I think that you'll find yourself really, really, truly engaged. I also think that Matt Damon did a really good job as well. He portrayed a general that was overseeing Oppenheimer's work at Los Alamos. But I would not call this a geek quote unquote film in the tradition of how we on this podcast have defined geekdom and geek films. I think the only way that it qualifies is
science.
You know, yes. Well, that, and I would say the Barbenheimer phenomenon. But you know, certainly if you know, Mel on here is the film school
aficionado grad,
and so you know, I'm sure she can enlighten us about Christopher Nolan and how and his directorial style, and you know, I'm sure she can give us a breakdown and a thesis on that, and that would be for our Geek Confidential film nerds out there. So I'll just leave it at that. But definitely, if you I think you're missing a big piece of the culture if you haven't seen Oppenheimer.
Is it wrong that it's just partly when it comes to World War II movies? First of all, I'm not generally a huge World War II era movie person, and if I'm going to watch one of those, I usually watch the European front, not the Pacific front version of movies. Some people will say like, oh, you're a nerd, and I'm like, no, I'm not a nerd because I'm not quite that hardcore. I feel like nerds are the people who are like the sci-fi nerds and the Star Wars nerds and the Trek nerds and the science nerds are all the people who are really into it and know every element, everything. I consider myself a geek, which in my definition is a slightly more casual than a nerd. And that, as much as I'm sure it was an amazing film, and I know that Christopher Nolan can do some stuff, I just don't know that I wanted to nerd out that much. I'm sure it will be nominated for a lot of movie or Oscars, and that will probably be the context in which I end up watching it, because if it's nominated for Oscars, then I'll be like, okay, I need to see this just because I want to see what is going to be up for nominations or up for the possible win. But I really don't think that in like 3 hours of my life that I'll never get back watching a movie about the atomic bomb, I would rather have 2 hours of my life that I'll never get back from watching Barbie and feel amazing about it when I'm walking out and being like, I'm Ken enough. I mean, that I'm sorry. I would just rather watch a Barbie movie than a World War II atomic bomb movie. And I don't care about the Barbenheimer hype, but that's me.
Well, I will say, okay, so one, just in fair, so though, you know, a good portion of the film is set during the World War II years, I would say a lot of the Robert Downey Jr. Portions of this film take place, you're getting stuff into the 60s. And so forth. And also,
another era that I'm not particularly enthused about watching films in. Like, I am not the person to go to when it's like, we want to watch stuff with like Rambo or various like Vietnam or like, I'm just not when a lot of those movies in those decades are not ones that if it involves war, I want to see.
Well, you get a lot about Oppenheimer's sex life. I will tell you that in this film.
That's not enough. That's not enough for me. Mel, did you have any comment on Christopher Nolan in light of the fact that he is a well-regarded director? I know you might have some thoughts on him.
You know what? He is a good director, and I think with every film that he does, there's certain things that you can count on him to do, but there's always something in his films that you're like, I didn't quite see that coming from you. And I do like that aspect about him. But my hangouts with Christopher Nolan is that man love a 3-hour film. And I don't always have the patience to sit there and watch the 3-hour movie because I feel like we could cut some of this out. I know at times too that he is also a fan of the nonlinear story, which always something that makes me pay attention. But at the same time, I feel like it, for his films especially, they don't always end in a resolution that exactly makes sense. So that's always something different. But with this being more of a biopic of things that actually happened rather than complete fantasy, I can see that going in a different direction here. I can tell, though, just from the trailers, the cinematography was beautiful, which is absolutely on par for any Nolan films. So I don't know if it's something I want to watch because, much like Luke, I'm not real big on the war movies. I don't love those. Like, it's got to be something of where maybe it's a rainy day and I don't have anything else to do and I'm watching this, but I'm not going to actively seek it out.
If I'm going to watch a World War II movie, it generally isn't going to be one about like battlefield stuff. It's going to be about some team of people who have to sneak behind an enemy line to rescue somebody or rescue something or get a message through. And so there's always movement and there's very little blood. Now, granted, this one doesn't have a lot of blood, but just like, I'm not a World War II era person. Mm-hmm. Now, a moment ago, Melody mentioned movies that do not make sense. I'm about to talk about a movie that makes no sense whatsoever, but is a ton of fucking fun. And that is Meg 2 The Trench. Meg 2 The Trench was awesome. It had every single moment of, including a shirtless Jason Statham scene in it, and it involved more Megs, a giant squid / octopus Meg, or whatever we want to call that version of the giant under the water trench creature that came up through the layer of whatever it was that has been keeping them down there. But what was so much fun about this film is the first one had all of these different characters and these different tropes. So like in the first movie, you have the trailer and with the people on the boat who are getting married. And then you have the little Yorkie dog in the trailer. And in like the advertising, you have the big old Meg coming up underneath the Yorkie, right? Or the underneath the tube. They brought all those people back. The people who were in the wedding on the boat in the first one were back on vacation on the second one. The Yorkie was there. The characters that were in the first one that were amongst the main cast that survived. The black guy who didn't really have any training in the first one. We find out in the second one, he was like, I am not going to be the black guy that dies on this. And he went and got himself trained how to fight, how to shoot. He had leveled up. Like in the gaming world, he had totally leveled up. Not that that anybody knew about that, but when the shit went down and that he was all of a sudden firing off and hitting targets with guns, he was like, one of the guys was like, where did that come from? And he was like, I learned my lesson. I wasn't going to have this happen to me again. The whole thing was just preposterous fun. And like, if you just like, if you watch the first one and got some chuckles and some laughs, and I'm not a person who loves gore and I don't like watching things that are like super like, Jaws is too like quote unquote intense because of the suspense. Well, because of the preposterous nature of this film and the attacks and everything, it's not so much that you are worried necessarily about suspense. Yes, there were a couple times which I jumped out of my seat, but for the most part, it's just action upon action with some pauses before more action and action. And so you're just along for this crazy ride. The villain was a caricature. Like, it was a total caricature. And it just, you have to enjoy the Meg movies for what they are. Preposterous fun with big fucking sharks. And it was so much fun. Did either of you guys watch it?
No, unfortunately, I did not. Luke,
you both need to watch this.
I didn't watch it, but I wanted to because the original movie, The Meg, I enjoyed that way more than I thought it would. So
right.
It was definitely a surprise one. It's one I didn't even see until it was on cable because it used to come on TNT all the time. So well, I was like, oh, there's a second one. This is going to be great.
Well, the first one is on streaming, mm-hmm. So you can watch it if you haven't watched that yet. But if the moment it comes out on streaming, you should watch it because it's a ton of fun. And like, I'm not into sharks. I'm not into like being trapped under the sea. When people have these movies about like, oh, wasn't there a movie that came out sometime in the last 12 months where these kids were going to go down into some underwater caves someplace and then really bad shit starts happening to them while they're trapped under the ground? That is not my type of film at all. At all. You will not get me into a movie theater to watch that. But preposterous Meg's attacking everything and like, and then a giant squid on top of it, and it's just too much fun. Mo, what else did I was setting Barbie aside because that's going to be our final one. What other movie stood out for you this movie season, this summer season for the last half?
Well, I have to say, the new Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie.
Was that good? I wanted to see it because I was very curious about the art style, but I haven't had a chance to get to it yet.
I think you have to go in with your... Well, let me back this up because I don't want people to make the assumption that it's something pejorative. I think that if you're going in expecting the Ninja Turtles from the 80s and the 90s, you're not going to get that. If you are expecting the something akin to the live action Ninja Turtles, you're not getting that. I would say that this is an interesting hybrid approach where it really did emphasize that they were teenagers and how the turtles interacted with Master Splinter felt very much like how some rebellious teenagers would act nowadays. They were somewhat defiant. But at the same time, they loved Master Splinter. I think that this was a Nickelodeon production, so there was a lot of goo and some slimy kind of aspects. The backstory for the Ninja Turtles was adjusted a little bit. I think that we did not get the Shredder. So if you watch this movie expecting, oh, where's the Shredder? Unfortunately, you're going to be disappointed. You do get a lot of Baxter Stockman. If you recall Baxter Stockman, the human fly from the old cartoon. I think that, Luke, as you mentioned, the animation style, it reminded me of some aspects of the second Spider-Verse film, especially there was one of the multiverses in the Spider-Verse film that I think had a similar sketchy style that they used throughout this film. Seth Rogen was the driving force behind this film. I think it's clear that he's someone who has loved this franchise his entire life. I thought that the Jackie Chan, who voiced Master Splinter, did a really good job. And overall, if you look on IMDb, if you look this film up, I'm not familiar with the other voice actors who portrayed the Turtles, but I think that each of them, they exuded being a teenager, and they were perfect in their roles. Again, I think that if you're a fan of the property, you should definitely check this out. Mel, your boy, Giancarlo Esposito, he voiced Baxter Stockman. So, you know, if that gets you interested in checking out that film, there's another character called Superfly who's in the film as well. That's voiced by Ice Cube. It's probably one of the more distinguishing voices in the trailers for the film, if you've seen it. So they were like really spot on, and they whoever cut that trailer and used a lot of Superfly, they really made the right call, because you can tell it's Ice Cube voicing that character. So overall, I think it was a solid film. I believe it's on streaming now. If not, it's going to be on Paramount Plus soon. Definitely a film that's worth your time. You're kind of in and out. It's a fairly tight movie. It's only roughly, it's not even an hour and 40 minutes tops. There is a post credit scene that sets up a potential sequel to this film, but you know, definitely, I think Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem is worth a shot.
I'm going to sneak this movie in here because admittedly, it's not technically a geek movie, and I was really stretching I was really stretching to try and come up with a geek connection, and I can't do it, so I'm going to just say fuck it and say I love Joyride. I had so much fun watching that movie in the theaters. I was crying with laughter. If you have not seen Joyride, you should definitely go see it. Let's talk about the biggest movie of the summer, and one that I feel deserves Oscar nominations, not just for acting, but for cinematography, soundtrack, etc., etc. Barbie. Mel, what did you think of Barbie?
I loved Barbie, y'all. I loved it way more than I thought I would. I know I grew up playing with Barbies. I had the Barbie bedspread. I had Barbie curtains. Barbie was my girl, okay? So I was already excited to go and watch it. And it took me a little bit to get there to see it because it was so packed and sold out. But when I finally saw it, I was so excited. Margot Robbie did a fabulous job playing Barbie. But I also loved Barbie Land, Barbie World, with all of the different Barbies and all the cameos we got.
Issa Rae as President
Barbie was so great. What's her name? Kate McKinnon as Weird Barbie. I thought that was the perfect person to play Weird Barbie, and everyone right? else, and everyone else who was in that film too. Like, that is the perfect representation of Barbie, because Barbie is all of us. You know, there's a Barbie everywhere, and she does everything. She's our girl. So I love that representation of it, and I love how they really held true in Barbie Land to all of the Barbie aspects of where, you know, she's not really eating anything, and she walks on her tippy toes, and she has all of the, you know, the Malibu beach house and the convertible car. I was like, this is fabulous, because I used to play with all of these toys. So it was just a really great bit of nostalgia watching it actually come to life. And I thought too that when they brought in the men, all of the Kens, the main Ken played by the beautiful Ryan Gosling, where you had them wanting to be more part of Barbie's lives, and Barbies were like, we don't need you. So, I mean, it's cute that you're around, but it is what it is. And
your
that was
eye
a
candy.
Really, yeah. And that was an interesting aspect of them wanting to be more involved and wanting to be more respected. And the girls were like, we run this, and it's cute that you're around. Thanks. You know, in the eventual storytelling of it, you know, everybody learns their lesson of how to treat people, which I thought was the ultimate message from this film, was just make sure you respect everyone and think about other people's feelings along with your own. And then I like, too, all of the transition scenes they had when you're going from Barbie Land to the real world. You know, first it starts with the roller skating, and then you have to jet ski, and you have to ride the bike. Like, all of that was so funny. And then she finally gets to the real world, and America Ferrera's character was the designer, and she's affecting all of her feelings, and she has her own daughter that she's struggling with, and all of the parallels there of how you navigate this new world where Barbie gets to the real world and women are the opposite of what she's used to. So watching her trying to really understand and figure out what's going on and how to get back and when she wants to be back. And Ken, he follows her and he gets the idea and he realizes that, oh, you mean we don't have to follow all of the girls' rules? And he goes back and he changes Barbie land and, you know, they have to try and restore the natural order of Barbie world. But I really like the way that they integrated the Barbie world and the real world scenes. And there were really great parallels, and I just enjoyed it. I really did. And I thought it was funny too that Will Ferrell was in charge of Mattel, you know, and it's this giant boardroom of men that are running all of these things, because isn't that the way it goes? So I thought all
and
of
ironically
that,
he was actually working out or looking out for Barbie mm-hmm. World, and I was surprised that for Will Ferrell he was actually fairly restrained. I'm not a huge fan of his.
I
love him in Elf, but that's about the only movie that I love him in. But he was, by Will Ferrell standards, quite restrained in Barbie.
You know what? People don't give him enough credit, because I really do enjoy him. Like, he does all the silly stuff. I love the Talladega Nights and the Old Schools and Anchorman. I love all of that goofy stuff. But for every goofy stuff that he has, like, there was he just did the Christmas movie on Apple TV. I cannot remember the name of it for the life of me. But he was good in that too, where he was a little more subdued. Like, they let him be goofy, but he kind of has some serious stuff in there too. So I enjoyed him, but I remember watching Will Ferrell when he was on Saturday Night Live. So anyways, I say that to say, he was great. I just loved the way, I love the way that they did it. They had all of the right aspects in it. To me, it absolutely lived up to the hype.
Mo, what did you think of Barbie?
Well, Mel, you know, I bow down to you. You know, a great summation of Barbie. You really captured a lot of my feelings as well. I will say, like, in terms of the Barbies that were represented, I really appreciated the fact that, you know, we got Barbies of all shapes and all sizes.
Didn't we get Alan?
Yes, we got Alan as well. In particular, if you watch a lot of television, there were so many actors and actresses you recognize. For me, like two of the Barbies that I saw that I wish got a little bit more screen time. One was Sharon Rooney. She's a British actress. She from Mad Fat Diary, and Nicola Coughlan from Bridgerton. She was also on there. So I appreciated, you know, again, just the variety that we got in terms of Barbie. And, you know, Luke, you know, we did get a little sneak peek of our upcoming Doctor Who, Shudigatwa. He was one of the Kens in there. And of course, you know, this wouldn't be a, you know, we got to make that shout out to DC by acknowledging, you know, one of the Kens was played by former One Life to Live actor Scott Evans, brother of Chris Evans. It was great to see him on film.
Office of Fish.
Yes, Office of Fish. you know, it's clear to me that the actors and actresses and just had so much fun putting it together, and that I think that I've only seen it once, but I have a feeling that it holds up.
This movie is going to hold up so well.
Yeah. I think 10, 20 years from now, people are going to think back, and in terms of 2023 and in terms of films that just utterly blew them away, this is going to be the film.
This is going to be the 16 candles. I mean, that type of thing for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, and so, and even the soundtrack is such an earworm, and it just the way it just how this film came together with Margot Robbie just really pushing for it, and I think that folks who were crapping on Margot Robbie because they're tired of her being Harley Quinn. I mean, this actress is very versatile. I think that, and again, she was a co-producer on Barbie as well. It's clear that she earned her payday.
Well, she also, like, Margot Robbie is amazing, so this is mostly a joke, but she damn redeemed herself after the atrocity of Babylon. That was a terrible movie.
Luke, are you still you feeling the after effects of the elephant dung?
The after effects of the elephant dung that are in the first 10 minutes of the movie, and you should almost walk out of it because of that from the very beginning.
Well,
yeah.
I think, you know, I will say that for as an actress, I think that
she's showing versatility.
Yeah, well, I think she did a good job in that movie as well, in Babylon.
I'm not saying that she didn't do a good job, because she was pretty much one of the only things to watch, but that movie showed that she doesn't necessarily... either she doesn't have good movie-picking taste, or someone on her team has terrible movie-picking taste. But I digress and don't mean to distract from the wonderfulness of Barbie. Any other thoughts on it before I weigh in?
I don't have any. I'm good.
Okay. I loved Barbie. I went to it and I was wearing a pink polo when I went to it. I thought that Margot Robbie was fantastic. Like, there are at least three, if not four, people who deserve acting nominations. The writing on this was so clever. You can tell that this was written by someone who had really thought about it, who really has a lot of love for the character or the franchise of Barbie, the icon of Barbie, and that they were willing to both tell a story that is obviously a love story to Barbie, but also acknowledge the many things about Barbie that might have been problematic at some points. They did a fantastic job. They call Barbie out in it with Helen Mirren's voiceover at one point, which was a fantastic moment in the film. And it was stunningly beautiful. It was just pleasure for your eyes. Directing, cinematography, writing, soundtrack, acting, this movie, I hope it cleans up at the Oscars winter, spring, whenever it ends up being because of the writer's strike, because it deserves it. It, for me, it was definitely the movie of the summer in terms of, okay, this was just a ton of fun. There's definitely other movies that are like action movies that would probably be my action movie of the summer, but Barbie as just a unexpected pure joy is definitely my movie of the summer. So looking back, both of you, at the movies that you've seen for the entire summer, which one is your best movie or your favorite movie? It doesn't necessarily have to be best, but your favorite movie of the summer from opening weekend, the first weekend of May through Labor Day. What is it for you, Mel?
You gonna make me pick one?
Well, yeah, the best, your favorite movie of the summer. This is the summer movie wrap up.
Okay, if I have to pick one, my favorite experience in the movie was Blue Beetle.
Okay. Yes. Mo, what was your favorite movie of the summer?
Well, I'm going to pick one. I'm not going to pull a Luke Kerr and do a tie. So in terms of like a knee-jerk reaction, I would have to go with Barbie. And one of the things that I failed to mention previously was Greta Gerwig, the director and the co-writer of this film. We wouldn't have Barbie. I mean, granted, Margot Robbie delivers a tour de force performance as the lead Barbie, but without Greta Gerwig's vision, I mean, this is a woman whose films constantly move you, whether it's Frances Ha, whether it's Lady Bird, whether it's Little Women. I mean, these are typically not movies. Certainly we would be discussing on the Geek Confidential podcast, but Greta Gerwig is a director I've been a fan of for a number of years. And so I tend to pay attention to when she has something coming out. But again, for me, I think Barbie is my favorite movie of the summer overall.
Barbie is definitely my favorite movie of the summer as well. I think that they did a fantastic job. And I'm in the camp where I do not want a sequel. I want this to be one of those movies that stands alone on its own for eternity and just becomes that much more iconic for them only doing this one. I realize that that is a very, very far cry, but I would rather have this perfect movie with this cast than to see this cast come back for a second one. If they want to do another Barbie movie that is completely unrelated to this one sometime in the future, cool. But I do not want to see them make a sequel to this movie. On that note, we'd encourage you to comment on this episode at geekconfidential.com. Follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/GKConfidential. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/GKConfidential. I'm on Twitter at Luke_Kerr. Mel is at Melody Akles, and Mo is at Dr. Mo 77.
That's correct, Luke.
We thank you for listening. Until next time, so long.
Bye, y'all.
Bye, everybody.